Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and we are going to dive right back into our Corey Richens trial coverage. My goal is to make all of these episodes around 30 to 40 minutes. That's usually what my typical weekly episodes are, and I know that you guys typically like that for your drives to work or your chores or whatever it is that you're doing while you listen to me ramble on. So that is what I'm going to do. If that means that I need to include 2 days in one episode, then that's what I'll do just to make everything flow nicely. So we're going to jump into day two. Yesterday, we talked about opening statements. Today, things kind of shifted from emotional family testimony to crime scene procedure and evidence handling. So the first one on the stand was actually a continuance from the day prior. It was Patrol Deputy Vincent Nguyen. The state continued reviewing body cam footage from the morning that Eric was found unresponsive. Deputy Nguyen testified that when he arrived, Eric was already deceased. EMS had worked him. Corey was pacing around the house. He described her demeanor as being unusual. He said that she was making crying sounds, but that he did not see actual tears. Well, when the defense had a chance to cross-examine him, they asked, "How many times have you seen this woman in distress before?" And he said, "None." And then they said, "How many times have you seen her in shock?" They said, "None." So the defense is, in my opinion, clearly building towards this, like, you cannot define how someone should grieve, you know, idea. And then Nguyen also testified that he did not see any THC gummies in the bedroom. He did not observe illegal drugs or any paraphernalia. He completed a death checklist and he logged who entered and exited the home. But again, we have this issue that the Moscow Mule cups were never collected. The lemon drop shot glasses were also never collected. The bedroom was never secured or treated as a homicide scene, and the defense is not going to let that go. They're kind of clinging to those pieces of evidence as a, you know, big part of their case. So the next witness was a narcotics canine officer, David Pimentel. He brought his trained dog into the Richens home after Eric's death to search for controlled substances. He testified that the dog did not alert to fentanyl. The dog did not alert to THC gummies. The dog did not locate narcotics in the bedroom. However, later searches of the home uncovered THC gummies in the trash and in various other places. Like, I think they found some in a coat pocket or something like that. But then, you know, that becomes a problem because the defense presses that if gummies were in the house, then why didn't the canine detect them? How can we count on this canine if he's inconsistent? And also, was the search thorough or was it rushed? The prosecution maintains that fentanyl can be extremely difficult to detect in certain forms and that THC products are not always reliably alerted on. But again, that seed of doubt has been planted. The next person on the stand was evidence technician Chelsea Gibson. This is where we start getting into forensic handling of the case at the Richens home. Chelsea Gibson participated in multiple searches of the home, not just the initial one, and she testified that she later recovered THC edible packaging. I guess they're kind of like in these gummy, when you give your kid fruit snacks and they're in a little package, that's what these packages looked like. She created a 3D digital walkthrough of the home. She documented pill bottles that were located in the bedroom. But here's the kicker. A hydrocodone prescription bottle was photographed, but it was never tested for fentanyl. So the defense zeroed in on why wasn't it tested? If fentanyl killed Eric, wouldn't you test every opioid container? It's not out of the realm of possibility that, you know, if he was some, you know, drug pusher, which I don't believe he was, then he could have kept the fentanyl in that pill bottle. I think that's what the defense is alluding to, but I don't think it's going to land with the jury, just in my opinion. Now, the state did not offer a dramatic explanation for this, simply that certain items were not submitted. And you could definitely note that the defense was kind of filing that away for later, because I think their entire theory hinges on what if Eric ingested something else? What if he ingested this himself? I guess we'll learn more about that theory as days go on. But day two was less about who killed Eric and more about, was this investigated as a homicide from the start? Because according to testimony, the cups were washed, the housekeeper was allowed in to clean the next day, the scene was not locked down for any kind of extended forensic processing, certain containers were not chemically tested. The defense is clearly preparing to argue that you cannot claim intentional poisoning when you didn't even preserve the evidence. The state's strategy also seems to be emerging, and it doesn't seem like they're panicking at all. They are more methodical. They appear to be laying so much foundation before they bring in toxicology experts, drug suppliers, and more digital forensic evidence. That was about it for day two. We're going to move on in to day three. Day three was kind of strange, not really in terms of dramatic testimony, but in terms of how little actually happened in court that day. The day started like every other, with the jury seated by 8:30 in the morning, and everyone was ready to continue testimony from the previous day. The witness on the stand was Chelsea Gibson again. She had started testifying on day two, and the defense wanted to continue pressing her about the evidence handling and processing. So defense attorney Catherine Nestor took the lead. She asked what exact steps Chelsea took before the search warrant was executed, whether she participated in the detective briefing before she entered the home, whether she knew if anyone was given advanced notice before the warrant was served, whether she searched vehicles at the house — she did not — whether she photographed liquor bottles, kitchen items, etc., whether any drug paraphernalia was visible — she said she did not see any. And then, of course, about specific items like hydrocodone bottles in the nightstand, which she clarified she didn't take them and they were with the medical examiner. So then Catherine Nestor questioned whether it would be possible for somebody to hide illicit drugs in old prescription bottles. And Chelsea affirmed that, yeah, technically it could be done, which is important because the certainty around how and when drugs got into the house is really at the core of this case. After about an hour of testimony, the judge abruptly paused the proceedings because there was a scheduling conflict involving a witness named Mr. Smoot from the U.S. Postal Service. And so that meant that court had to take a 1 hour recess. But then when the hour passed, the judge just didn't bring the jury back and then instead dismissed court for the day early. All right, so let's move on to day four. Day four was the big moment that the prosecution had been building towards. This is the first major eyewitness who claims that she got drugs for Corey Richens, including fentanyl-related pills. Her testimony was emotional, contradictory at times, and full of credibility battles between lawyers, and it really just consumed nearly the entire day in court. However, before that, they did wrap up testimony with Chelsea Gibson and brought in Dr. Brianna Peterson, a forensic toxicologist who has worked in that field for about 20 years. She explained the toxicology process and how it works, that they received blood, urine, liver fluid, and other samples from the medical examiner, and that a screen was performed for multiple drugs. She testified that fentanyl was found at 15 nanograms per milliliter, and norfentanyl was also found in the system. So Dr. Peterson also tested for hydrocodone. None was found in his body. Hydrocodone, importantly, has a half-life of 4 to 6 hours. So it's not to say that he never took it earlier in the day, but that, you know, obviously it wasn't in his system when he died, and that's what matters. Now, 3 nanograms is a lethal dose of fentanyl. In Eric's body, there were 15 nanograms. So 5 times the lethal limit of fentanyl. Additionally, ethanol, fentanyl, norfentanyl, and acetylfentanyl were also detected. Important to note, acetylfentanyl is solely seen in illicitly manufactured fentanyl, not in prescription fentanyl. So that is important. Next on the stand is Summit County Sheriff Detective Frank Root. For the prosecution, Prosecutor Lindsay Shervinak asked about an iPhone 7 that was collected from Corey's boyfriend, Josh Grossman. Root is then excused but expected to come back, likely to testify more about exactly what was found on Grossman's phone. Again, just another laying foundation move. Then Chaney Ng Tao was next on the stand to testify about the Cellebrite data collected from two iPhones that had been collected. Basically, this just confirms that the Cellebrite data cannot be manipulated. Again, laying foundation probably for more to come. And of course, if you're familiar with true crime or even like the Karen Reed trial, you've heard about Cellebrite multiple times. They will completely extract all the possible data, even things that you've attempted to delete. Cellebrite can usually pull that. So, and we'll get into that because Corey did make some searches that she tried to delete. So the next witness was Brian Holden with the Utah Bureau of Forensic Services and the Utah Crime Lab. He was given 19 items to test specifically for fentanyl, but was not able to detect fentanyl on any of those items. Noteworthy, of those 19 items, he was not given an empty pill bottle to test. All of these witnesses were short-lived, and by the time they wrapped up, it was time for lunch, and then after lunch, the jury was introduced to Carmen Lauber, the former house cleaner for the Richens family who supplied Corey with illicit drugs multiple times. Carmen described how she knew Corey. She originally worked with Corey's aunt and cleaned Corey's home regularly years earlier and knew both Corey and Eric personally. But by early 2022, she was no longer cleaning for Corey. She has a history of struggles with addiction to various illicit drugs, but claims that she has been sober for the last 4 years and is currently on probation through drug court. However, she was given 4 grants of immunity for testifying against Corey Richens. So the defense will likely attack her credibility as a witness, as well as her character as someone who struggles to keep the details of her stories completely straight. So Carmen spoke with investigators before she had immunity, but wanted immunity. Carmen did not consult with an attorney before meeting with investigators. She was in jail. She has since met with her attorney in preparation for her testimony, but I think that that's an important thing to note because, you know, she's in jail. They're offering her immunity. I mean, that's an incentive to cooperate. And I know that the defense will probably, you know, try to really harp on that for the jury so that they get this idea that, you know, you can't believe everything she says because what if she's just lying for immunity? Essentially, you know, I think that's kind of the defense's goal. So Carmen walked jurors through multiple times that she bought pills that she believed Corey wanted, including stronger opioid pills, and pills that she later identified as likely containing fentanyl. She said that the emotional catalyst for her reaction was when she learned Eric actually died of an overdose, prompting her to call Corey and say, "Please tell me these pills were not for him." And Corey allegedly told her, "No, they were not. Eric passed away from a brain aneurysm." So the thing that they really wanted to nail down, the state, when she first was on the stand, was how many times did she get drugs? And they wanted to go through each of those 4 times. You guys, there was so much back and forth. It was so easy to get confused on what they were talking about. I mean, even Carmen was getting confused and frustrated when the defense was on cross. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to break down each time one by one as I understand it, but you have to understand in court, they were bouncing around between all these times. And if it was the defense's goal to confuse the jury, they might have succeeded because this was very confusing. I obviously have the benefit of like hindsight and getting to watch and go back and I can rewind the video to like see it, you know, confirm what I think I'm hearing, but the jury doesn't have that luxury. So anyway, that being said, let's talk about the 4 different times that Carmen testified she obtained pills for Corey. The first time was early February 2022. This was about a month before Eric's death. Corey asked for something stronger than regular pain pills. Corey said she was getting them for an investor of hers. Carmen got opioids via a friend, Susan Kohler, to give to Corey. Carmen gave Susan $600 for an envelope of little brown pills, and the next morning, Corey drove to Carmen's house to pick them up. Corey repaid Carmen the $600, and that was the first time. the viral like meme, I guess, of Corey looking at her with her eyebrows raised, like, oh, really? Are you really saying that right now? Has to do with Corey driving over to Carmen's house. That was when she made that face, as if she has never been to Carmen's house, I guess, is maybe what she's trying to imply. But obviously, Corey can't talk. So the second time that Corey got pills from Carmen would be mid to late February. Corey called again and indicated that she still needed pills that were, again, stronger than normal pain pills. So Carmen chose to go with a different dealer this time. This dealer was Robert Crozier. Carmen and a friend, Nancy, drove to a Maverick gas station in Draper to meet either Robert or Robert's contact. And this was the batch of pills that Carmen believed contained or consisted of fentanyl and not just oxycodone. This time, the pills were light green in color. Late February, Corey contacts Carmen again, telling her that the investor needed something stronger, described at one point as the Michael Jackson stuff. Now, important to note is that the second time she got pills was mid to late February. There was a point, it was Valentine's Day, so February 14th, that would be mid-February, when Eric ate a sandwich that Corey had given him and then got really sick and, you know, laid down. And that's when he said, you know, if I'm not feeling any better soon, I'm going to take myself to the hospital. And then for 90 minutes, he had no activity on his phone. When he did come to, he called his business partner, Cody Wright, and Cody Wright could tell that he was really scared and shook up about what he had just been through. And so when you correlate those dates that she had reached out, that Corey had reached out to Carmen mid to late February, suggests that maybe she had gotten those pills and that that's what caused that sandwich incident on Valentine's Day. And that would also make sense as to why time number three was in late February, and this time asking for something stronger, because obviously Eric didn't die on Valentine's Day. And, you know, now she is saying, I want the Michael Jackson stuff, which we know killed Michael Jackson. So Carmen contacts Robert Crozier again, and this time Corey left about $1,000 at the Midway property for Carmen to pick up. Carmen picked up the money and met with Robert at the Maverick gas station. Once she arrived, Robert approached the car, picked up the money, and came back about 20 to 25 minutes later with a clear baggie that was containing pills. These were about 15 to 20 light blue pills in the baggie. Carmen and Nancy then left, and on the way back, Carmen texted Corey and asked her what to do with the pills. Corey told her to take them to the Midway mansion and put them in one of the sheds. Carmen did not feel comfortable putting them in a shed, so she dug a hole in a fire pit and put them in the dirt and covered them up. After learning that Eric had died, Carmen became worried that Corey may have given him those pills, so she told Corey on a phone call, please tell me those were not for him, to which she replied, no, Eric died from a brain aneurysm. Before we go on, I want to take a moment to thank the sponsor of today's episode, and that is Time for Learning. Now, let's talk about it. Something I know a lot of you have either thought about or you're already doing, homeschooling. And if you're in that season of life where you're craving flexibility, or maybe your child just doesn't thrive in a traditional classroom setting, I want to tell you about Time for Learning. Now, Time for Learning is an all-in-one online curriculum for pre-K through 12th grade. It covers all the core subjects plus electives, basically everything that you could expect from a traditional school, but built for home. And what I love about it is the flexibility. You can mix subjects each day, you can focus on one subject at a time, take learning on the road, or adjust your schedule around your real life, doctor's appointment, travel, just one of those days. You're not locked in to rigid school hours. They even have something called the Cinema Series for middle and high schoolers, which are story-driven, visually engaging courses that feel way more modern and immersive than what most of us grew up with. And for parents, this is huge. They provide transcript templates, grade tracking, and planning tools that align with homeschool requirements in all 50 states. So you're not just winging it and then hoping that you did it right. Because I know that a lot of people who struggle with the idea of homeschooling worry about the fact that they're not competent enough to teach their kids these like intricate lessons, but you don't have to think about all of that. They've been around for over 20 years and have served more than a million students. So this is not just some fly-by-night program. Families actually trust it. If you're curious if Time for Learning is right for your family, visit time4learning.com. That, again, is time4learning.com to explore their curriculum and find the perfect plan for your student. And you can get started with a monthly subscription to see just how much your kids enjoy learning on their own terms. That's timeforlearning.com. Now, time number four. She obtained pills after Eric's death when Corey asked if she still had her hookup. There is a text exchange between Corey and Carmen from March 6th and 7th of 2022, where Corey texts Carmen, "Still have your hookup?" End quote. Carmen told her she could reach out to Robert, and Corey said, "Okay." Corey told Carmen that the investor, would leave money under the doormat of Corey's home in Camas. Nick picked Carmen up and drove her to Corey's, but when Carmen walked up to Corey's house, the money wasn't where she said it would be, so she knocked on the door. Corey let her in, and while inside Corey's house, Carmen said Corey wrote her a check for $1,300. In the memo line, Corey wrote, "Construction clean Midway." But Carmen alleges that it was actually money for drugs and that she had never made $1,300 for a cleaning job before. The check was dated March 6th. Carmen went to the bank to deposit the check. Her account was in the negative, so she deposited $300 and then took out $1,000 in cash. Then Nick and Carmen drove down Provo Canyon to pick up the drugs. She texted Robert, but it was taking a while, so she and Nick stopped at some antique stores to pass the time, and they eventually ended up at Maverick and Draper. When Robert arrived, they followed Robert down the road to a duplex. Robert came out of the townhouse with a baggie of round, dark blue pills, and Corey then instructed Carmen to leave the pills in a closet at the Midway house, which she did. Sometime later, Robert reached out to Carmen and told her that he had more supply if Carmen's contact needed it. So Carmen reached out to Corey and asked if she needed any, but Corey told her she didn't need them anymore because her investor was, quote, out of town. And I think that's an ironic choice of words when you consider who we believe the drugs were actually for, because if they were for Eric and not an actual investor, and Eric has died and she's saying he's out of town, it adds to the calculated callousness. Then during cross-examination, the defense hammered her repeatedly on this. The idea that she would keep picking up pills for Corey even after Eric's death makes Carmen's purpose hard to nail down. Was it loyalty, a residual habit, or something else? I almost wonder if it was Corey's intent to get the pills to stage them and like hide them around the house so that somebody might find them and then bolster this idea that Eric had some addiction that he was dealing with. Or maybe she was just doing it to create an alibi, like, no, see, it really was for an investor, because why would I need pills for Eric after he already died? So I don't know. I think the investigator or the investor does not actually exist. I do kind of wonder why they haven't just flat out asked, like, who is the investor? Like, if you really want to save yourself here, just bring this investor to the trial. I mean, this investor could save your life. For all the hookups that you've been giving this investor, the least he could do is come testify that the drugs you bought through this drug dealer were actually for him and not your husband, who is now dead of a fentanyl overdose, right? Like, it seems pretty simple if you're really trying to win this case. So I don't know why they haven't addressed the elephant in the room, which is basically that. So the defense also on cross wanted to attack Carmen's memory contradictions. So Carmen once told detectives that she had bought pills once from one dealer and twice from another, but on this day she testified differently with more transactions and altered details about where pills were left. So Wendy Lewis repeatedly referenced Carmen's own statements that she had foggy memory issues due to long drug history, and that she had been told by prosecutors she wouldn't be charged if she cooperated. So Carmen conceded that her memory wasn't perfect. Obviously, this was 4 years ago, and the situation has been very stressful and confusing. And at that point, they wrapped up day four and moved on to day five. So I think the last day I'll talk about for this episode is day five. Day five shifted from Carmen Lauber's drug testimony to something equally significant in my opinion, which is the financial trail. Prosecutors spent the day walking jurors through money, debt, insurance policies, business ventures, and the pressure that was building in Corey Richens' life in the months before Eric died. I found day five to be very fascinating because the just lawlessness with which she was getting all this money and spending it like a mad woman is just kind of mind-boggling. Like when you hear some of these numbers, it's like, what the hell? Why were none of these lenders saying, hey, this is not a good idea. Like, look at the way you're running your accounts into the ground. I mean, it is pretty fascinating. So here, let me explain it to you. So the morning began with Detective Frank Root returning to the stand. So remember day four when he briefly testified about collecting an iPhone 7 from Corey's boyfriend, Josh Grossman? Well, day five, prosecutors started kind of connecting the dots. Root discussed communications that were pulled from phones, including text messages and financial records that were later extracted through Cellebrite. Much of this was foundation, establishing authenticity, confirming devices belong to specific people, and laying groundwork for future testimony. But the undertone was clear. The state is building towards showing overlapping timelines between Corey's marriage, her alleged affair, and mounting financial strain. The defense objected at several points, arguing certain lines of questioning were speculative or beyond scope, but Judge Mrazek largely allowed prosecutors to continue. Then the focus moved heavily into finances. Jurors heard testimony about real estate transactions, loans and private lenders, lines of credit, missed payments, and insurance policies. The prosecution's theory is that Corey was in significant financial trouble, over $4 million in debt tied to property ventures, and that Eric had begun to push back, particularly regarding real estate deals and life insurance changes. Witnesses explained, which I want to just make a quick note that in the coming days, we learn more and more about all the details and the actual numbers. So anytime I say something that might seem vague, it's because I'm trying not to get ahead of myself. I want to tell you exactly what happened on this particular day without getting into what comes later, just so that I don't confuse anyone. But anyway, witnesses explained how Corey allegedly had multiple high interest loans that were coming due. Payments were stacking up. There were literally payments every single day. To stay afloat, she utilized four payday lenders with high interest rates, committing to pay $2,100 per day to each of them. She was making debt payments of roughly $80,000 a month. She was having constant overdrafts between January 2021 and March of 2022 when Eric died. Her accounts saw 236 bounced checks totaling over $300,000, which resulted in thousands of dollars in overdraft fees. This is just scraping the surface. I'm sure we'll get into more of those details as the days come on, but this just gives you an idea of how I'm sure stressed she was. I think that creates a pretty desperate situation to try to solve that problem, which I think just adds or bolsters the state's argument that she, you know, needed a way out and her marriage was struggling. She was having an affair. I mean, she had every reason to commit this crime. Witnesses explained how Corey allegedly had all of these high interest loans coming due. The payments were stacking up. There were concerns about foreclosures. Prosecutors carefully walked jurors through dates, including what properties were purchased and when loans were taken out and how much was owed. I mean, she went like full throttle within 3 years, buying as many doors as she could. I say doors, I mean like properties as she could. And it racked up pretty quick. And I think her goal was always, you know, I'm going to buy these crappy houses, fix them up and sell them for a profit. But what actually ended up happening was she would buy these houses and then rack up a ton of debt in renovating them and then rack up all of these interest payments. And then by the time she'd sell the house, she'd be in the hole on those houses. So she just didn't know what she was doing. She's playing business, essentially. Jurors were also reminded that Eric had an existing life insurance policy. Testimony suggested that Corey attempted to increase or alter the policies at various points before his death. Though not all of the changes were successful. So she would go on there and try to change beneficiaries to her. For example, there was a life insurance policy that Eric and his business partner Cody had on each other. This is very typical when you have a company that is owned by two people. The idea is that you purchase a life insurance policy on your partner, and then if something were to happen to your partner, the life insurance policy would cover whatever the amount is that it would take to buy their share of the company. So, Corey would go online and try to change the beneficiary of those policies, not understanding the ultimate purpose of those policies, which is in the event that one of the partners dies, then the other partner can get the money to keep the business afloat. Like, this is not just a random life insurance policy, but the fact that she was trying to change it to her own name was really shocking, because if you knew what the policy was for, then it would be like, there's no reason. There is no justifiable reason to change the beneficiary of this particular policy to Corey. So we'll get into more details about that too, because the insurance agent, and as well as a customer service representative who helped them kind of navigate who was making these changes and what the changes were, comes to testify in the coming days. So we will elaborate on that. But the defense countered with the idea that financial stress alone does not equal murder. On cross-examination, they emphasized that many families carry debt. Many families invest in real estate and manage high loan balances without resorting to violence. They also highlighted that some of the financial decisions were joint decisions between Eric and Corey. There was also testimony touching on Corey's business operation and bookkeeping practices. So jurors heard about how funds moved between accounts and how certain payments were labeled. The prosecution appears to be suggesting deception in how money was categorized. You know, that we see this also in the check that she wrote Carmen Lauber for $1,300 and put in the memo line that it was for cleaning. I mean, we're kind of getting used to this picture of a person who is manipulative and kind of bends the truth to suit her goal, I guess, her agenda. Although that argument has not been fully made yet, they are still kind of building that whole case, that whole argument. The boyfriend angle also remains present, but not yet fully developed. And in the coming days, we will hear from Josh Grossman, the boyfriend. His testimony was painful to watch. I'll put it that way. So we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But for now, I'm going to go ahead and leave you with this, and I'll come back with the following days in the next episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me. If you enjoy these recaps, maybe comment or, you know, review, share this episode with your friends, or your social media. I would appreciate it a lot. Until next time, stay safe, stay curious, and stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.